It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying. There is no running, there is no hiding. There's only fighting or dying. It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying. There is no running, there is no hiding. There's only fighting or dying.
It's Going Down is a digital community center from anarchist, anti-fascist, autonomous, anti-capitalist, and anti-colonial movements. Our mission is to provide an autonomous and resilient platform to publicize and promote revolutionary theory and action.
Go to itsgoingdown.org for daily updates. Check out our online store for ways to donate and rate and follow us on iTunes if you like this podcast.
Okay, once again, we are joined by Peter Gelder-Lowes. It's been a while since we talked. It seemed like so long ago, but you know, some of the things that we're talking about now have become much more clear, whether it's in terms of trade or Trump. You know, obviously a lot of things have changed, some haven't. But just to dive into it, you know, looking at the end of 2018, looking back on this year, what are some of your big takeaways?
I think the big takeaway of 2018 is that, oddly enough, it's a bad time to be in power. All of the dominant players seem to be on very shaky foundations. Places in the world where you have far-right governments in power, their basis, the gains that they've made are being threatened. Places in the world where you have neoliberal governments in power, they're completely on the ropes. U.S. hegemony on a worldwide scale has eroded remarkably in just 2 years. China, for a long time, the fastest growing major economy and set soon to become the largest economy in the world, also seems to be heading for a major slowdown, if not worse. On the level of ideologies, on the level of structures, on the level of specific political parties or dynasties, it seems that at the moment, and for the first time in a very long time, the top is maybe the shakiest place to be. Of course, it's by no means great on the bottom, but those dynamics of resistance coming up from the bottom are certainly increasing the pressure. It kind of feels like the world is one big pressure cooker that maybe hasn't been screwed in too tightly. So it definitely, I think, seems like one of those moments that precedes a very large change on a world scale.
You know, just one thing you mentioned, I find very interesting. You mentioned that that the far right governments or right populist governments that have come into power, they're facing contestation. Can you talk a little bit about that more? I mean, how is that so? How are they facing a challenge?
Yeah. Let's see. Starting with what I think historically is maybe the most important, or certainly the first country in this far right coalition of governments, Israel under Netanyahu. You may have read he's facing the possibility of new corruption charges, some dissension in the ranks, a part of his coalition government has been backing away from him, and he's maybe in the securest position of any of them. In Hungary, there are large protests that have started because of new labor laws and new laws that Orban has passed to try to really create like this sort of model of a one-party, multi-party system where one party has effective control over all the branches of government. I want to get back to Hungary more a little bit later because there's some interesting things there. In the UK, it's just a total disaster. It's not very clear what anyone in the Conservative government there wants because the Brexit negotiations are a disaster. A no-deal Brexit would be probably a bigger disaster. They would probably, even a lot of the pro-Brexit campaigners would probably like to cancel Brexit, but they would lose a lot of face if they have to go through another referendum. So the image of a stable, sensible British democracy is very much on the line. Of course, there have been recent right-wing victories in South America with Brazil, but it's far too soon to see what happens there. Right. And then, of course, in the United States, people are backing away from Trump. He's,
right. Yeah. Festering sewer of just everything coming apart all at once.
Yeah, yeah.
And we're going to talk about Steve Bannon and, you know, quote, the movement later. But thanks for giving us that rundown. You know, last time we discussed how the U.S. is essentially being cut out of new economic formations. While at the time it was unclear as to what would come out of Trump's trade war. You know, looking back now, what are your thoughts?
I think it's roughly the same situation as a year ago, but with a couple important developments. So the Trans-Pacific Partnership, it was set to be the largest free trade area in the world, but because Trump backed out, it actually didn't fall apart. It went ahead without the U.S., but of course without the U.S., it's only the third largest free trade area in the world. And so that's significant that the U.S. isn't in that. It's very likely that if the Democrats win in 2020, they will get the U.S. into that trade partnership. But once the U.S. backed out of the TPP-11, the other countries actually abandoned a lot of the elements of that trade treaty that the U.S. had been insisting on. For example, allowing corporations to sue governments in order to reduce standards relating to fossil fuels. It's important to keep in mind that at this point, the U.S. is actually the number one oil producer in the world. So if the U.S. does eventually join the TPP and make it the largest free trade area in the world, it will actually be on the terms, not of the U.S., but of the other countries that are already in that, and that disadvantage some of the U.S.'s economic demands. Brexit is being a total mess, and until Brexit gets resolved, the U.S. doesn't have the possibility for a bilateral trade agreement with Great Britain. That's something that earlier on Trump had indicated wanting, and that is something that could offset the trade losses that Trump has incurred elsewhere, the trade losses that the right-wing government in the U.K. has incurred through Brexit. But it looks like that won't be a possibility for years, possibly, if at all, depending on how Brexit goes. Finally, there's the situation with China. That China is the area where Trump is actually hewing closest to national policy interests from the perspective of the U.S. government and U.S. capitalists. For a long time, the U.S. economic and political elite were just completely suckered by this Milton Friedman view of China, that if China continues to liberalize and develop as a capitalist economy, then its political system will also come to mirror that of Western capitalist governments more. And the Chinese Communist Party has completely... I mean, it's ridiculous that anyone still believes in the free market or that free markets actually exist. But, you know, I mean, it's a religion. So every few years you'll have another major event that demonstrates how absurd that belief is. And the big event now is the story of China's economic development with a preeminent role for the state controlling and planning that economy, but also lots of room for private capital to invest in.
Because it turns out a very authoritarian government and, like, you know, all powerful party actually goes quite well with, you know, private property and wage labor.
Yeah, exactly. And there's never been really any other way except with multiple parties, but still with strong state intervention. So the U.S. economy doesn't work without constant state intervention, but there's just this ideology that the economy just happens by itself. So right. Yeah, so they fell into their own quasi-religious beliefs.
Which is funny because, I mean, we've said that before in this program, but I mean, it's clear that like no one actually believes in, it seems like no one actually really believes in capitalism anymore. I mean, obviously there are diehards that are running around with copies of, you know, Atlas Shrugged, but I mean, if you look at everything Trump has done, I mean, like, how is tariffs and, like, you know, all this stuff that he's doing, you know, not a planned economy? How is it not socialism for, you know, some segments? How is it not state intervention? I mean, it's all these things.
Yeah. And like when the U.S. government decides whether an American corporation can buy or be bought by a Chinese corporation, or can have its parts made for Huawei or things like that. It's, I mean, it's, there's this constant planning, and there already always has been. But so basically the one thing that Trump did there, just because he has evidently no shame, no fear of messing things up, and no awareness of his own ignorance or propensity for error, he was able to break the orthodox position on China and actually start a much more hostile relationship with China. It's interesting looking at, for example, New York Times coverage of Trump's China policy, where Trump can easily be ripped as just an absolute moron anywhere else in the world, or as a completely amoral strongman, for example, with as regards his relationship to Saudi Arabia. There's a lot of appreciation, not only across the Republican spectrum, but also from many Democrats, about or regarding his hostile stance towards China. So that is something where, in the interests of the U.S. wanting to dominate the world, there actually is a conflict between the U.S. government and the Chinese government, and it took someone like Trump to break the orthodoxy of just hoping that increased trade would eventually bring about political liberalization in China. So so that would be the one place, China policy, where there isn't just this total absurd right-wing ideology which is actually decreasing U.S. hegemony. The question remains, however, though, as to whether the U.S. even has the means to prevent China's economic ascent. I'd say it probably doesn't. A trade war could certainly slow it down, but it just makes it all the more necessary for China to achieve technological self-sufficiency, for example, with fabrication of microprocessors or other things like that, for which it currently relies on the United States. So it could slow it down 10 or 20 years, but in the end, even make it create a stronger basis for like a Chinese economic global dominance.
You know, one thing we haven't talked about is the reworking of NAFTA. Do you have any thoughts on its current reiteration? I know that they came out with a new plan, it seems like.
Yeah. I haven't read too much into this. My understanding is that the changes were, I mean, you know, Trump like got himself a media victory. But my understanding is like the changes were not that extreme. I think he got just like a portion of what he was initially asking for. And the question is how much is that worth, like the goodwill of traditional U.S. allies like Canada and Mexico. In the end, it doesn't. I don't think it changes very much the nature of NAFTA, and it certainly reveals the absurdity of these pretensions of a free market, because they're hammering out deals in which they're agreeing what quantities of different products to buy from one another.
Right. Well, now turning towards an essay that you recently published on CrimeThink. This got a lot of people thinking. Talks about just kind of certain predictions as far as the near future. But one of the things that was written in it that caused some people to disagree was that you wrote that fascism in the United States can't really gain a foothold because there are not big elites that back it with enough money. I mean, a lot of people have pointed out historically, there's like three main pillars that, you know, cause a fascist movement to erupt. It's a angry declassed kind of middle class. There are, you know, elites with money that can back it, and also like media that can kind of ferment these ideas. But can you flesh this argument out a little more? I mean, people have kind of pushed back on this from people that we've talked to, but the idea that you don't see fascism in the U.S. growing because there aren't elites to back it.
Yeah, it's I would make it a bit more nuanced than that. But above all, I would make a distinction between fascism on the streets and fascism as a political movement with a chance for taking over the country and inaugurating a fascist dictatorship. With fascism in the streets, I would make the distinction between some kind of neo-fascist movement and more democratic strains of white supremacist movements, like we've always had in the United States, that see their role as propping up existing democratic institutions, but understanding those institutions as being there in order to uphold a certain hierarchical order, an order which is, above all and from its inceptions, racialized. That particular view, I think, is actually a fairly accurate summation of democracy in the United States. The United States has always been a democratic country, and it's been one that has used democratic and diffuse means to uphold a white supremacist system. Whether or not fascists, as opposed to democratic white supremacists, sort of take over the predominant chunk of those street movements, I think that's possible, but that comes down, I would say, primarily to white supremacy and how white supremacy operates in the United States. Historically, fascist movements have not been predominant in the extreme right in the United States because of the nature of the U.S. as a settler state, because of the need for white supremacy to be reproduced by decentralized, diffuse means in the United States. However, we're seeing large changes in how race is talked about or not talked about, how it's understood in this country. So there actually is the possibility for a cultural rupture with historical white supremacy in the United States. I'm not saying that means that things would get better, that they would change, certainly. And I think it's undeniable that in some very visible ways they are changing. In other words, whether or not fascism on the street becomes predominant in the U.S. far right doesn't depend on fascism itself, but it depends on white supremacy and its historical development. Whether white supremacy in the U.S. needs that continuing diffuse support or not. And so I think that's a question that on a theoretical level has to be answered primarily with a look at what white supremacy historically has meant in the United States. And in my mind, that's something that that a lot of the folks with whom I disagree haven't adequately looked at.
I think people would agree with that analysis, but what they would say is like, well, what about, for instance, like the Mercer family, who has, like, you know, put a lot of you know, money behind, you know, right wing populists, and maybe they're not fascist per se, but they do seem to be pushing a different variant than, like, for instance, the Koch brothers. But even, for instance, the Koch brothers, recently it came out that they're, like, floating about 85% of, like, the Daily Caller's, you know, budget, which is pretty incredible. So, I mean, there is some backing, even if we're just defining this as, like, you know, democratic white settler, you know, democracy. I mean, there is major backing from elites for this.
I think being able to point to a handful of mid-range capitalists doesn't really meet the level of support from industrialists and capitalists that you saw in historical cases of countries that went fascist, Germany, Italy, etc. I mean, there's you're always going to find like a pretty large diversity of opinions among capitalists, of ideologies among capitalists. And for I mean, you can just pair off the collective fortunes of the Mercers and the few others who have been supporting the extreme right with the fortunes of all of the other capitalists who overwhelmingly support relatively open border regimes, a move away from nationalist politics. So the support of the Mercers and a few others have made it possible for the Richard Spencers out there to exist and to have the reach that they've temporarily enjoyed. But being able to take over such an established and powerful and wealthy governmental system like the one in the U.S. would take a level of resources several orders of magnitude higher. I mentioned that I wanted to talk about Hungary, and I think that this would be a good point. So Orban has been able to establish a pretty strong grip on power in Hungary. He's taken advantage of absolute majorities to pass laws that give more power to the executive. And one of the things that he's done, which for the first time is showing cracks in that power, has been passing the so-called slave laws, which allows employers to force workers to work up to 400 hours more overtime, which is essentially like working one extra day a week overtime. They can't say no, and employers can delay payment for up to 3 years. So it's basically getting like 400 hours of free labor from workers every year. So people have started protesting that increasingly in Hungary. Why did Hungary pass this law? Not just as a handout to their capitalist friends to take advantage of the fact that now the government there has a stronger grip on power, but also because Hungary is facing the same labor shortage that countries across Europe are facing. A few years ago, when this labor shortage came up in Germany, that's when Merkel decided to welcome middle-class Syrian immigrants, refugees, to Germany as a direct response to the economic needs of the German market for more qualified labor, for more educated workers. What Merkel was doing was completely in line with a standard center-right-wing politics, especially one that prioritizes capitalist growth over human needs. And the far right, not only in Germany but across Europe, has ripped her to shreds. And in doing so, has ripped to shreds the strongest and most stable bulwark of the European common market and the European government. And they've done it in a way that has actually shot capitalists in the foot. They've shot their own friends in the foot. So now you have countries like Hungary, which championed this extremely xenophobic, racist rejection of these immigrants, who need those very immigrants in order to rescue their economy, which is on the point of collapse due to labor shortages, and they can't because of their own far-right ideologies. We can see similar things in the U.S. It's just such a clear-cut case with comparing Hungary and Germany and what's happening in Europe. But in the U.S., Silicon Valley, which is has been one of the strongest sectors for like a relatively stable and consistent economic growth in the U.S. until very recently, it constantly needs relatively open border regimes to be able to siphon off what the capitalists call intellectual capital. So people with brains, people who who can go to university or who have been to university and can study how to become computer programmers and so forth, from all over the world to go to the U.S., to go to Silicon Valley, where they'll get paid more than anywhere else, where they'll kick out the folks who have historically been living in the Bay Area and so on and so forth, Seattle, et cetera. So capitalists need that. They need that desperately. And the far right denies it to them. So not only is the far right not responding to any of the concrete needs of capitalism right now, but it's actually making things worse for capitalists. So because of that, you really don't see, if you poll capitalists, financiers, you know, the captains of industry, and so on and so forth, across the world, you won't see strong support for those kinds of changes. So that's why I think that pointing to the Mercers and a couple others who between them have what, some billions of dollars, in other words, peanuts, really doesn't demonstrate a realistic grasp of the scale at which capitalism is operating, and also the kind of needs that governments have to satisfy.
Fair enough. Well, I know we're going to talk a little bit about France, but first I just wanted to ask you about something that Stephen Miller said over the weekend. You know, tragically, there was a 7-year-old Guatemalan girl that passed away, was picked up at the border with, about 150 other people for about an hour and a half, did not receive medical attention, got on the bus, got off the bus, started vomiting. They took her to the hospital, airlifted her, and she died the next day. In response, the Republicans have really doubled down on their talk of shutting down the government in order to fund their border wall. Stephen Miller went on TV on Sunday and is kind of repeating this mantra that's being used by, I feel like, a lot of the right. And I've seen this a lot of in a lot of arguments in support on the right side in support of the Yellow Vest movement in France. But like, for instance, he said, you can support, the working class in the United States and support the border wall, or you can have open borders, but you can't have both. And it seems like they're really pushing this thing. And this is obviously not a new line, but like, there's limited resources. If you have immigrants, they'll take those resources. They'll hurt the workers in those countries, and that, we've got to keep them out in order to basically make things better in the United States, or, keep a certain standard of living. And I'm just curious, how would you respond to that line of thinking?
I think even entering into that debate is questionable, just because of all the things that it takes for granted: a capitalist economy, people existing happily as workers, national identities, governments, borders, and so forth. I think people who have a need to engage in policy debates, for example, could come up with plenty of statistics about how resources are actually spent. I think what we need to be doing, and what is happening a lot, is creating more relationships in the streets with other folks fighting border regimes, fighting against the dehumanization of immigrants, and also just consistently drawing ties between the wealthy and talking heads or right-wing activists or others who have these racist politics and who are spreading this these racist politics. One really strong fact or statistic about job loss is just the preponderance of jobs that have been lost to robotization, to mechanization in factories. Obviously, we're not going to blame the robots. That's a decision that was made by company bosses in order to increase profits, to cut costs by laying people off. So that's I think an argument that needs to be continuously made, that if people in the States are in economically in some kind of desperate situation, it's because of landlords who are charging rent on buildings that have already been paid for years ago. It's because of the bosses who are laying people off in order to make more money. And she's just showing the connections, both ideologically and economically, between those who are holding up these scapegoats in a very racist way and the people who are actually profiting off the whole system.
Well, it's a similar line of thinking with, we've got to be more tough on crime. We've got to have more prisons. Though crime, violent crime has gone down for decades. I mean, likewise, in the United States, we've seen, decades of border militarization. Thousands of people have died in border crossings. you know, we have more and more technology on the border, more and more drone surveillance, and yet that doesn't, you know, mean anything for American workers. It hasn't stopped jobs. You know, Trump hasn't stopped jobs from, you know, flowing overseas through globalization and outsourcing. And even in Bob Woodward's book, Fear, Trump in the White House, the new one that just came out, you know, there's a passage in there where Trump is picking his, you know, political team before he goes in the office. And they're saying the same things. They're saying, like, you know, if you're going to be in office, if you're going to be in the White House for 8 years, you're going to see 25% of the workforce be displaced by automation. And the first group that's going to go is going to be drivers, because that's going to be killed through autonomous self-driving cars and all that. I mean, they're not talking about immigrants taking jobs. They know this stuff. You know, they know what's true. You know, this is just a useful scapegoat to them. But, I mean, we see the same line of thinking in the U.S. We're seeing it with kind of their narrative of how they want to see the yellow vest protest, because they want to see it as, you know, the immigrants coming from the third world, displacing, you know, the white worker, you know, as a result of climate change, or, you know, white genocide, or, you know, whatever narrative they want to swing with. But I don't know. I think it's important to really push back against this stuff, because especially as the right tries to appropriate the language of class, which, you know, the center refuses to do, it's important to really, you know, destroy that stuff.
Absolutely. And that's probably where the fascists have been most important. Basically, by popularizing these racist xenophobic discourses, and then allowing the right, the center, and even parts of the left to set a new normal, to reabsorb these xenophobic politics that are blaming immigrants for problems caused by capitalists, which is something that absolutely is in the interest of the system, and maybe that's one of the central arguments that I was trying to make, is that the danger of the far right is less in a model of fascism that might represent a future direction, but in what it has allowed the democratic system to absorb and to
promote. Oh yeah. Completely. Yeah, no, I would agree. It's not so much that it's, you know, there's going to be a totalitarian state that, you know, is like a revolutionary people, you know, created out of, but, you know, just that it offers, you know, the democratic state kind of more tools in order to, you know, contain the contradictions and tensions within society.
We're the gamers, deciding to fly against the sky. Within our dreams we all wake up to kiss the ones who are born to die. We're the gamers, hurting each other with our lives. Within our dreams we all wake up to kiss the ones who are born to die. The drumfish, they beach themselves in Harukari. The blackbirds, they fell in thousands from the sky. Their red wings streaming down from the higher seas. Deflected by the ground, they crown the sun, they crown the sun.
These are the stakes. We must either love each other, or we must die.
Our statues, the soaring edifice of our times, detracted from the ways of
we're at war with the most dangerous enemy that has ever faced mankind in his long climb from the swamp to the stars. There's no place to escape to. This is the last stand on Earth.
We're the neighbors, deciding to fly against the sky. Within our dreams, we all wake up to kiss the ones who are born to die. We're the great race, hurting each other with our lies. Within our dreams, we all wake up to kiss the ones who are born, born to die. They crown the sun,
they crown the sun,
they crown the sun,
they crown the sun.
But I believe that they are free when their time was done.
Their time was done.
They were drowned.
Well, just moving forward, I know that originally we were talking about if we were going to talk about the Yellow Vest stuff and what's going on in France, and you said that you didn't want to touch on it. What are your thoughts on what's happening there? It seems like things have kind of simmered down a little bit, but obviously this is a seems to be a major turning point in revolt post-economic crisis, and especially against neoliberalism.
Yeah, part of the diagnostic of the future, part of the article on CrimeThink is about how climate change and official responses to climate change provide a unique opportunity for a new synthesis for the political needs of state, for economic needs. It provides a new discourse and set of blueprints for reorganizing society according to the needs of government and capitalism. And one thing that's really interesting in the Yellow Vest movement, since what's most directly being protested was the fuel tax intended to decrease greenhouse gas emissions. The state, of course, is passing the costs of that on to working class people, but those people are receiving it directly as just another austerity measure, just another neoliberal measure. So they're placing it in the same basket as pension reforms, as wage cuts, and so forth. So that I think that illustrates beyond the questions of what's the actual political identity of that movement, which of course it's something that's multifaceted, that's not homogenous. But beyond that, it shows some limitations on the possibilities of governments to respond to climate change, especially if they don't differentiate it from these austerity measures that they've just been hitting people with really hard this last decade or two.
Yeah, it just shows that they're really not, the state is not going to really try to reorganize society in a major way, outside of what already exists. And of course, any rational approach to climate change is going to take a huge change in the way that we produce commodities and use energy.
Yeah.
Well, just kind of continuing on with talking about the right, I'm curious your thoughts on Steve Bannon's recent push in Europe to build this thing he's calling the movement. Are you pessimistic about this? Do you see this as a big threat? How do you see kind of Steve Bannon's recent foray into Europe?
I think that there's definitely a a danger, and I mean, there's been a real increase in coordination by the far right across Europe. A danger, the dimensions of which we'll see in the upcoming elections for the European Parliament. I think the focus on Steve Bannon, I'm not sure if that's more prevalent in the US or maybe the US and the UK, more in English-speaking media. I'm not sure that Steve Bannon brings anything new to the table or I'm not sure I would identify him as a specifically important element in the threat, just because these movements have been organizing for a long time and pan-European coordination predates Steve Bannon. It's something that's already been happening. I think in general you already have in most European countries far-right parties with a lot of experience, a fair amount of political savvy, and so forth. So independently of whether Bannon is here or not, it's something that people have been keeping an eye on. It's something that certainly a growing danger. Their possible turn towards the European Union raises a lot of questions for me. One possibility is that they will focus on getting their policy goals adopted by existing structures and existing parties. For example, the Alternative für Deutschland, the far-right party in Germany, celebrated how the center-right party and even some people on the left have been adopting their anti-immigrant policies. So that shows more a desire to win certain policy goals within a democratic framework than a desire to take over, because of course if it were the latter, then they would feel threatened by other parties adopting what had been, you know, their winning recruitment strategy. But there's without a doubt the possibility for right-wing Eurosceptic parties to sabotage the European Union. And there's ongoing conflict right now with Poland and Hungary, excuse me, where the European Union is taking action against the governments of both of those two countries for decreasing the independence of the judiciary. So that depending on how strongly they do in the European Parliament elections, and then where they go with it, will probably have a huge influence on the future of state strategies for control in Europe.
Well, now let's turn back to the U.S. I mean, obviously the situation is changing all the time, but I mean, your view on the Trump administration, what do you think is going to happen just with things, where things are at? Do you think that Trump is going to make it to the end of his term, or, you know, you think that he'll run again in 2020? What do you see happening?
I think it's more important to stay attuned to the range of likely possibilities than to make specific bets. But it seems very, very possible that Trump could be impeached in the House but not removed from office in the Senate. Mm-hmm. And I get the feeling that the majority of Democrats would prefer that anyways. They can humiliate Trump, put a check on him, but still get to run against him in 2020, as opposed to a more competent candidate. The Democrats have probably an endless capacity to surprise us with incompetence. So, I mean, you know, who knows? The Republicans could win in 2020, but unless there's some kind of economic miracle, which I think is extremely unlikely, then the Democrats have an overwhelming chance to win in 2020. I think overall they'll use their majority in the House to show muscle, to you know, motivate people to show that, you know, they can hold this government accountable. So they'll use their committees to carry out investigations and so forth. They might even have the possibility of indicting Trump after he leaves office. I don't think that Trump would get removed from office as things stand now. And if that changes, I think that we'll see it coming in advance, as, you know, if there's some new big controversy that even upsets Republicans, or something like that. So I think, you know, if that does change, then anarchists in the States will have long enough to figure out what, if anything, that would mean in the streets with Trump out and Pence in. But yeah, it's probably going to be 2 years in which the U.S. government isn't able to pass a lot of legislation or make major policy changes or anything. So that means, you know, the government's dirty laundry will be aired out more. There will probably be more possibilities for frustration and anger in the streets. So that's potentially a good situation to actually talk about real issues, just not like bullshit the government's doing, but to talk about how borders actually affect people, to talk about climate change, to talk about racist cops, and all the rest.
I mean, do you see Trump getting any sort of legal trouble over, I mean, he's in like the middle of like 6 or 7 major lawsuits right now, maybe more?
Yeah, without a doubt, he's indictable. I think it really comes down to what do the Democrats want to do in 2020 or whenever it is that he leaves office.
Mm-hmm.
That's going to be a political calculation. You know, will they win more votes by punishing him and you know, giving people like this satisfying sense of justice?
Lock him up.
do they just want the whole thing to go away? So that's going to have very little to do with any legal basis for indicting Trump, which already exists, and more with Democratic strategies about elections.
Well, you know, speaking of the economy, I mean, all the time from both Trump and the Democrats, we just hear about how great the economy is. We know that, you know, people are working longer for less and less money. You know, the growth in the economy is largely in the service sector, the gig economy, and so on and so forth. And also there are signs that there could be a major crash soon, and this seems to happen within capitalism about every 10 years, so seems like we're due. But we've talked about this before, but do you foresee an economic crisis in the near future?
We shouldn't bank on it, so to speak. I think it's important when anarchists talk about the future to always be ready for anything, but you know, maybe to decide how we place our energies depending on what's most likely. And I think a major economic crisis is extremely likely. As of December, stocks are down in every single sector, which is the first time that's happened in decades. There are currently no feasible immediate horizons for economic growth. Investors have nowhere to invest, which is bringing sure returns, and that in itself could be enough to cause all the different
How is that possible there? That there's no way for them to invest
in that brings safe and strong returns, so they can get like very, very low returns with buying government bonds and whatnot, but in terms of stocks in different industries,
the tech industry
is falling. All the different industries, like in all the major sectors, stocks are down, and so that's it's been a long time since that that happened. So,
and is that just because growth has caught up with the fact that, you know, we actually don't have that much money to buy all this crap?
That's one of the things that's pretty much hardwired into capitalism, capital accumulates exponentially, And so it's going to accumulate faster than it creates new opportunities to invest itself. So that's why bubbles and crises have always accompanied capitalism.
Sure.
Like you said, we're due. You can never predict with assurance when exactly it's going to happen, but as long as it's capitalism, it's going to keep happening.
Let's say that it did happen within the next, before Trump leaves office in the next 2 years. I mean, what do you think that would look like per se? Because, you know, under Obama, we saw bailouts, and then we kind of saw this restructuring of the economy towards, obviously, more service jobs. You know, that opened the door for the gig economy, which, of course, is going to, you know, paving the way for AI and more automation. I mean, do you think that another recession would just kind of like open the gate for a lot of that stuff, or what would it like? What would the ramifications look like?
I don't think it would map so clearly onto the 2008 recession, because during the 2008 recession, you still had multiple economies that were growing. Mm-hmm. So China, for example, largely escaped the 2008 recession, which means that capitalists in the U.S., in Europe, who didn't lose a lot of money in a few specific funds or banks, had a place to invest their money, to continue making money. If you have a collapse which is completely global, to be perfectly honest, I don't know what that would look like. In terms of what people should maybe be thinking about and be ready for, would be mass unemployment, like having an idea of like what sectors of the economy are much more contingent, what sectors are more stable. Certainly, people should be thinking about fighting for housing, fighting against evictions. Because that, without a doubt, would accompany an economic crisis, whether people are renting or whether they're paying mortgages. If you have sudden inflation, if you have a spike in unemployment, you're going to have a lot more people who are going to be kicked out of their houses. And the good thing about thinking about that is, even if there's not, even if somehow this economic crisis doesn't come about, we as anarchists haven't lost any time whatsoever thinking about how to resist evictions, how to fight for housing, how to spread this idea that housing belongs to the people who live in it and not to the people who own the paper. Because even in periods of economic growth, you know, folks are still getting kicked out of houses, and houselessness in the U.S. has always been through the roof. So that would be one. I mean, thinking about survival is, a waste of time, especially if it leads to us addressing survival as a collective problem and coming up with ways to survive together, coming up with functioning models of mutual aid. And certainly thinking about feisty, combative, solidaristic responses to evictions and the housing crises.
Would you foresee if that, like, let's say there was another economic crash, do you think that would mean a lot of people leaving cities? Like, so for instance, like, let's say there's a crash, would that mean, like, for instance, like a lot of younger millennial workers that are just working service jobs that are like just barely getting by, would you foresee them like being like forced out of cities then, because of different economic reasons, or no?
It's possible, but it really depends on
the reason. I ask is because, you know, like we're seeing like all these, you know, massive tech companies coming into cities, like, you know, Amazon and Google are, you know, getting ready to like build these new headquarters, which are gonna in different cities, which is just gonna accelerate, you know, gentrification in a lot of ways.
Yeah. Some countries you might see like this Midwest Rust Belt effect as property loses value. In other places you probably would see real wages as compared to housing prices, a lot of people losing access to housing. Mm-hmm. Even between the tech companies, I mean, I think probably Amazon would suffer a lot more than Google, just because Amazon's workforce is so much based on filling orders on consumption, which falls when there's an economic crisis. Google, of course, relies on advertising revenue. That would be a problem. But a lot of their workforce is about designing new technologies. And in situations of more instability, it's certainly, that's also an opportunity for governments to shake things up, to re-engineer society in a way. And any authoritarian re-engineering of society in the near future would, I think, be based on an even more invasive intervention of technologies into our lives. The agricultural system is definitely due for revamping, surveillance systems, and so forth. So I think certain types of jobs would, what they lose in terms of private customers, they would make up for with government contracts and whatnot for, whatever happens. If there is an economic crisis, then eventually you will see something like a New Deal. Ultimately, it has to be a state that rescues capitalism from crisis. Capitalists on their own historically haven't been able to do that. You actually could see policies that are a lot more socialistic in nature being the result of an economic crisis if it does happen. So things like
universal basic income
and so forth.
Yeah, because if you talk to people in cities across the U.S., a lot of them are ecstatic about the idea of an economic collapse, because that would mean that housing prices would hopefully go down, and that maybe they could buy a house, or their rent would go down. I don't know if it actually works like that. Things just might actually stagnate for a while.
I think usually it's the people on bottom who tend to suffer.
Right.
In those situations. So I think absent a very strong anti-capitalist movement, stronger than what we've seen in the last decades, we're going to be worse out the other side of it. More of us might have health care. That's always a good thing. But generally, look at working class struggles in the U.S. before and after the New Deal. I don't think it's something to be excited about unless we have very good plans and a very high opinion of our friends and comrades.
Right. Well, just kind of moving forward, one last kind of broad geopolitical question, but definitely there is a tension between the U.S. and China. We brought this up before, but there's people within the Trump administration people that have formerly been in the Trump administration who foresee, a coming conflict with China. I know that in the last couple of months, there's been different conflicts that have arisen between the U.S. and China over, who's in what part of what ocean and all that stuff. And there continues to be threats of military action along both sides. This has been heightened by the trade war. Do you want to comment at all on this conflict?
Yeah. Some kind of conflict there was inevitable, just because it's an authoritarian world system, and when the balance of power changes, then the pecking order has to change. The relationship between the top dogs has to change. There's a possibility that the conflict can play out primarily through capitalist means, in which you can have, at least as far as elites are concerned, you can have win-win scenarios where everybody who's got money profits, but just some profit more than others. But then there's also the possibility of a hot war. If you look at where military force is being demonstrated. It's largely in the South China Sea, and I would say that at this point the United States doesn't have much possibility to thwart the Chinese government's ambitions in the South China Sea, just because, I mean, the U.S. obviously has more military power, but China at this point has enough military power that it can check the U.S. close to home. So without getting into a hot war, the U.S. can't kick China out of these artificial islands that it's already built up. To what extent China can use that to assert a monopoly over, like, the oil and gas resources of the South China Sea, for example. I mean, if they are able to start building first, then in effect it's theirs. One thing that I was looking into recently that potentially changes the dynamics of these global conflicts in a pretty scary way is the U.S. Missile defense system, which was tested again recently and successfully in Hawaii. I mean, it's like, so the whole idea of mutually assured destruction, it's psychopathic. It's basically, you know, two different countries have nuclear weapons. They're not going to get into a war because it wouldn't be in either of their interests, because they would both be completely destroyed. I mean, it's absolutely psychopathic that we're governed by people who developed nuclear weapons capable of wiping out all life on the planet. It's absolutely chilling that they can just calmly rate the advantages of having these weapons and even sell them as a tool for peace. And of course, if you look at it historically, in the 60s, they seem to have like the sort of death wish and even be drawn to the possibility of using these nuclear weapons and, you know, getting to live the next 100 years in bunkers while everybody else just died. So there were multiple times where it almost came to nuclear war. But it's even scarier, excuse me, if one country with nuclear weapons has a missile defense system, so they can use nuclear weapons or just conventional military force against another nuclear power and know that they'll be able to shoot down most of the nuclear missiles going for them. That's enough of the game changer that it could lead to a situation where the U.S. would be willing to use conventional military force against China, but even especially, I would say, against Russia, for example, around Ukraine or something like that, knowing that, okay, maybe like one or two nukes might get to the U.S., but, you know, it would just kill like a few million of us. All the military people would be safe, and then they would be able to totally obliterate their adversary. So that's a lot scarier, and that would come from the U.S. I'm pretty sure that China is content just to be able to assert autonomy on what it would refer to as its backyard, as a larger part of its corner against the world. I don't think China has any intention of getting into a hot war with the U.S. But the U.S. with this missile system could potentially become much more belligerent against China, or respond to Russian belligerence with.
Yeah. Well, just kind of one last question. We've been talking now for a while. It's been a great conversation. One last question to kind of close us out. You know, in the Crime Think essay at the end, you kind of laid out going forward in the future some things anarchists should keep in mind, going forward. Can you lay these out for us and just kind of talk about what they are?
So in the Crime Think piece, as you probably noticed, I was fairly pessimistic about anarchists and anarchist possibilities. And I want to go into that. I want to explain that a little bit. In the U.S., in multiple other countries, we have honestly accomplished some amazing things in the last 10 years. We've changed the discourse on multiple issues, or been part of broader movements that have changed the discourse on multiple issues. We've been an important part of spreading combative tactics of collective self-defense, know-how for taking over the street. We've in some places toppled a couple government administrations, anarchist involvement in in movement against police was important in movement against pipelines. So all of these movements where we were part of these very broad coalitions. We've really interrupted the neoliberal consensus, the social peace. That's extremely important. But my feeling is that what we need to accomplish in the conflicts ahead are a much taller order. They require so much more out of us, and they require types of advancement or skill sets or aspects of struggle that I think have not necessarily been our strong suit, right? So a strong anti-capitalist response to major economic crisis, for example, and to the certainty of ecological crisis requires very strong projects of mutual aid that allow us to survive and struggle and come out of this not only alive and you know able to keep going on but stronger and also projects for mutual aid for collective survival that can really scale up or that can expand and be reproduced and include everybody else out there or a significant portion of other people. And we've seen great examples of this in action with like mutual aid, natural disaster relief efforts. That's really important. But at the same time, I think there's a lot of reason for pessimism. I think there's so many examples of us just failing miserably at taking care of one another, at not disappearing from one another's lives, at not resisting technological changes in our lives that push us towards greater and greater alienation. So, I mean, there's potential there. There's some promising directions, but it really feels like the overwhelming trend is is towards this more alienated culture in which we, you know, treat each other shittily or we forget about one another. And I think we really need to break with that in a radical way and in a way that can also include other people. And that's just an extremely tall order. How do you, create, past generations struggle, there have been questions of combative countercultures. But how do you do something like that works internally, but that also doesn't close in on itself, but is constantly expanding and including other people? So for me, I think there's a big question we should be thinking about regarding what will the conflicts ahead look like? Because when you're living in a moment of neoliberal consensus of social peace, going and starting a riot when the cops murder someone, or going and starting a riot when a bunch of bankers and world leaders come to town to meet, that in itself is a very important thing. But when people are increasingly dependent on state structures for their survival because everything's falling apart, I'm not exactly sure that anyone would even notice a riot. So that's, I don't want to communicate that pessimism in order to, to demotivate people, to depress people anymore. We're already dealing with like this world level trauma that, I think a lot more people are feeling ever more intimately in their lives. But I think it does help to be realistic and to think about priorities or to think about, what we need to be learning how to do as fast as possible.
Any other things you want to talk about? Anything you have working on you want to plug, or anything else that you want to touch on before we sign off here?
Just to send a shout out to folks back there who are fighting against the border regime, fighting against the pipelines, doing natural disaster mutual aid, doing prisoner support. I mean, I think, you know, we've had some great victories in the last couple of years in the U.S. and other countries. So just give a shout out to people to keep on fighting, not get exhausted, and take care of one another, and figure out what it is that we need to be able to keep doing what we're doing and to do it better.
Awesome. Hey, thanks so much, Peter. We'll talk to you soon.
Yeah, thank you.
This has been the It's Going Down podcast. Check itsgoingdown.org for daily updates, columns, action reports, and news. Go to itsgoingdown.org/shop to support us, and follow us on all social media platforms. IGD, your daily resource for insurgent proletarian life.